From Port Charlotte, Florida, home of Family Life Center International and St. Joseph's Covenant Keepers, welcome to Faith and Family. For the next hour, join Steve Wood and his guests for a lively discussion about our faith and our families. You can become a part of this program by calling toll-free 1-800-994-2050 anywhere in North America. That's 1-800-994-2050. Now here's your host, Steve Wood.
Hello, this is Steve Wood, and welcome to Faith and Family. Pope John Paul II has declared, "The future of the world and of the church passes through the family." We believe that your family life is vitally important. These Faith and Family broadcasts are designed to offer practical assistance to your family and to families worldwide. Today we're going to be talking about the Jews and the role of Judaism in salvation history. We're going to go all the way back to Abraham, as well as going way forward to some often forgotten events preceding the second coming of Christ. Many people have heard all types of comments regarding the relationships between Christians and Jews that have arisen over Mel Gibson's movie, The Passion of Christ, and we'll maybe be dealing with some of those issues as well. Now, my special guest today has written a book on the topic, and I must say the book is absolutely packed. So I'm going to do today what I did when I had Scott Hahn on our last broadcast with Scott and his new book. It was packed well. I'm going to try to ask your questions to our author so we can get through the content of his book. There's a lot here. We're talking about 4,000 years of history with some things I think you're going to hear today you probably have not heard before. And so we want to cover those things. So I will be taking your emails, and that's simply radio@familylifecenter.net. And try to keep your emails short, because in a radio broadcast, I'm doing about 10 things at once, and a long email, I simply don't have the time to read. But if you have a question for our guests, send me a brief email question or comment at radio@familylifecenter.net. And then just for today, we're going to suspend the call so we can get through this important topic today. My special guest is Roy Shulman. Roy grew up studying Judaism under some of America's most prominent rabbis, and having received degrees from the Harvard Business School, he taught at Harvard. His unexpected conversion to Catholicism led to a dramatic refocusing of his life, and he is the author of the book Salvation is from the Jews, recently published by Ignatius Press. And to follow up on some of the conversation we're going to have today with Roy Shulman, you might want to visit his website as well, which is salvationisfromthejews.com. And we'll be giving that out through this show today, and that's also the title of his book, salvationisfromthejews.com. Roy Shulman, welcome to Faith and Family.
Hi, I'm very happy to be here.
Now, I'm sure by the time I was halfway through your introduction, some of our listeners were wondering, how does a nice Jewish boy like yourself, growing up in a Jewish suburb of New York, end up a Catholic? I mean, let's hear the story.
Well, the short answer is because another very nice Jewish boy named Jesus wouldn't let me alone.
Okay. How did this transpire? Tell us a little bit about your childhood, your experience with Judaism growing up, and then let's shift then into your pilgrimage.
I had a very devout nature growing up. It was a gift from God, but I grew up with a love of God and a desire to know Him and to serve Him as much as possible. And I had full faith in the Jewish religion, so I sought to fulfill that yearning through Judaism, which is what brought me into contact with some of these prominent rabbis. I grew up in what's called conservative Judaism, which is fairly observant, but not the most observant and strict segment of Judaism. But then when I turned 16, 17, I actually got involved in Hasidism, which is pretty much the strictest denomination within Judaism, and even lived and traveled with a Hasidic rabbi who has had a very high profile and still has quite a high profile, even though he's now deceased, Rabbi Shlomo Carlbach. Really trying to get an experience of God and to know intimacy with God as fully as I could. And I did have tastes of it. I did have flashes of it. I did have some experiential knowledge of the sweetness of the Lord, as the psalm says. But then I went to MIT, got involved in both the secular scientific mindset, which dismisses pretty much the idea of God, and also got involved with the contemporary moral norms of the 1970s, which are not really consistent with intimacy with God, and drifted into a kind of benevolent agnosticism, which is where I found myself.
If I can just interrupt you a moment, and I'd like to come back to this even later in the broadcast, but in your testimony, you mentioned, I'm reading from page 357 in your book, you say there's a close relationship between the maintenance of purity, both in mind and in behavior, and intimacy with God. And this is an issue that I've seen pervading the church at this moment, is that many people want an intimacy with God, but with the internet and all of the allurements through pornography and everything else and sexual sin, which is so much accepted, you basically are saying a warning that you're not going to have both. You're going to have to make a very hard choice.
There's even a worse and more frightening outcome, which is, it's easier to describe in Catholic terminology, but the indwelling activity of the Holy Spirit is pretty dependent on being in a state of grace. And if one is in a state of mortal sin, one can't really expect the consolations of the Holy Spirit. However, there's another spirit who loves to imitate the Holy Spirit and who loves to give his false version of consolations and deceive you into thinking it's the Holy Spirit. And we see that tragically in, frankly, these New Age practices among Catholics, because that's exactly what's going on. They're not in a state to know the consolation of spiritual activity from the Holy Spirit because they perhaps have fallen into these vices. So they're drinking from very polluted waters instead.
Okay. Just kind of a follow-up comment and question as well, because I know it has come towards me and other evangelical minister converts to Catholicism. Others have said, well, they really didn't know Protestantism, because if they had, they would never have become Catholic. And, you know, a lot of my fellow converts, and I think I would include myself, we had a pretty good handle on Protestantism. We did very well in our seminary studies, and we didn't stop there. We continued our studies long afterwards. No, we knew Protestantism and made a choice. Anticipating an objection towards you, I mean, you just very quickly went through your background, but you knew Judaism.
I knew Judaism probably more fully than at least 95% of American Jews. I did not know it as well as some, but I was not a kind of a, you know, cultural but not religious Jew.
Right? Okay. All right. Well, let's go on with your pilgrimage.
So then I found myself going to MIT, going to Harvard Business School, doing extremely well at both places and being invited to join the faculty of Harvard Business School. I think I was 29 or 30 at the time, which was quite a success, felt like.
That's the big stuff.
Having gotten the brass ring to be a professor at Harvard at 30. I was moved, if I may make a bit of a digression, when I heard Mel Gibson's testimony on a recent TV interview. I mean, he was much more of a success, but I had a similar kind of phenomenon, which is once I had everything which I thought should make me happy and satisfy me, the sense of emptiness becomes much more pronounced, because you're not striving for something and you can't imagine what there is left to strive for, and yet that emptiness, that void inside, is still there. And that is pretty much the state I found myself in. And in a lot of interior darkness and despair, I was walking in nature early one morning, because that's where I found my solace. This was in the dunes of Cape Cod. And I received the single most probably spectacular grace of my life. It's hard to describe, but from one moment to the next, I sometimes describe it as saying I fell into heaven. I found myself in the immediate presence of God, who I knew was my God, my Lord, my Master. I knew that he had watched over every moment of my existence. I knew that everything that had ever happened to me had been the most perfect thing that could possibly have been arranged by divine providence, although I was unaware of it at the time. And I found myself looking back over my life in his presence, as though I were looking back over my life after death. And I saw everything that I would be happy about and everything that I would wish I had done differently. And I was aware that the two things that I would most regret looking back on my life over death was all of the time and energy I wasted worrying about not being loved when every moment of my existence I was being held in a sea of love far more intense than anything I could imagine, although unaware of it. And the other great regret would be every hour that I wasted not doing anything of value in the eyes of God, in the eyes of heaven. I knew from one moment to the next the meaning and purpose of my life was to worship and serve this God who was revealing himself to me. The only thing I didn't know was his name and what religion to follow in order to do that. And so I prayed on the spot to know his name so I could love and worship him properly. I remember praying, let me know your name. I don't mind if you're Apollo and I have to become a Roman pagan. I don't mind if you're Buddha and I have to become a Buddhist. I don't mind if you're a Krishna and I have to become Hindu. As long as you're not Christ and I have to become Christian.
Okay.
And so he respected that prayer because he didn't reveal his name to me. But then when I went back home, the experience, the state of consciousness faded, but the experience, of course, never faded. So when I went back home, I still, of course, knew the meaning and purpose of my life. And every night before going to sleep, I would say a short prayer to know the name of the God who had revealed himself to me on the beach.
At the same time, you would ask him not to reveal it to you.
That's right. That's right, which is why it took
a while. He honored your will.
He honored my will.
Yes.
But he worked slowly on bringing me around. Of course, he knew my interior will. So he presumably knew that after about a year, I was ready to hear the answer. And a year to the day after the first experience, I went to sleep. And I felt as though I were woken by a hand gently rocking my shoulder. I know that physically I was still asleep, that physically this took place in the context of a dream, but I can only describe it as I felt. And I felt like I was gently woken and led to a room and left alone with the most beautiful young woman that I could imagine. And to simply be in the presence of her love, of the love emanating from her, was to be in a state of ecstasy greater than I imagined could exist. I knew without being told that this was the Blessed Virgin Mary. And she said that she offered to answer any questions I might have. She said I could ask her any questions.
Wow. I wish I could have been there. Okay, what did you ask?
Well, I'll tell you, the first question I asked, I found myself in her presence. She was so exalted and magnificent that I was overwhelmed with the desire to honor her and to give some sort of obeisance to her. So actually my first question, I didn't even know the Hail Mary. And I was painfully aware that I didn't know the Hail Mary because I knew if I knew the Hail Mary, I'd want to drop to my knees and say the Hail Mary. So my first question was, what's your favorite prayer to you? Because I want to know how to honor her. And her initial response was, I love all prayers to me. But I was Jewish. I still am Jewish, right? So maybe I was associated with being a little pushy. So I then said, oh, come on, you must love some a little more than others. And she relented and she recited a prayer to me. And it was in Portuguese. And I knew without being told that the reason it was in Portuguese was because the Portuguese people had maintained a kind of a particularly like innocent devotion to the Blessed Virgin Mary that was particularly pleasing to her. And I memorized the prayer phonically, I mean by sound, so that I would remember it the next morning. As soon as I woke up the next morning, I wrote it down phonetically. And I believe that the prayer that she told me was, Immaculate Mary, conceived without sin, pray for us sinners who have recourse to thee. And later a Portuguese woman told me that that's the first prayer that Portuguese mothers teach their infants as soon as they're able to speak. So knowing that, I think that may have been one of the reasons why that prayer was particularly dear to the Blessed Virgin Mary. Anyway, I asked, I mean, it would take more than the hour to go through all the questions I asked, but she answered all of them most graciously, and then she spoke to me for about 20 more minutes, and then the audience was over. And the next morning when I woke up, I knew that it was Christ that I had met on the beach. I knew that I wanted to be as fully and complete and well a Christian as I possibly could. I still didn't know anything about Christianity. I didn't know what a Protestant was. I didn't know what a Catholic was. I didn't know, you know, anything. So I just looked in the phone book for a church, and I started out.
Well, what else? You did. Yeah, no, good for you. You have to do something. Okay.
But I'd go to a Protestant church, and I would shyly bring up with the pastor after I knew him a little bit, you know, what about the Blessed Virgin Mary? Because I never fell out of love with her after that first experience.
Absolutely.
And when he would respond in a kind of insulting or dismissive way, which actually unfortunately happened, you know, I would just say, I'm out of here. And I was hanging around Marian shrines out of my love for Mary. And, of course, the Marian shrines were all held by the Catholic Church. So over time, between my love for Mary and my desire for the Eucharist, because when I was at the shrines, I would be exposed to masses. And I would really want to receive communion, and I knew that I wasn't allowed to. So between wanting to receive communion and my love for Mary, over about the course of 18 months, I was led to the Catholic Church.
Unbelievable. That's tremendous. Now, you mentioned in your book that you don't feel that the word conversion, although it's a common term, the word conversion may not be the best word or the most accurate term to describe a Jewish person who makes the pilgrimage to Catholicism. Why is that?
I think that's absolutely correct what you're saying. And it's one of the reasons I wrote my book is, in some sense, you could say that the book is a 350-page explanation of why it's not conversion at all, among other things. But the issue is not who we are. The issue is who Jesus is. If Jesus is and was the Jewish Messiah, then it's not conversion at all. There are only two kinds of Jews. There are Jews who are mistaken about who Jesus was, who are what society thinks of as Jews, and there are Jews who realize who Jesus was, who are essentially, quote, converted Jews, but they're not converting at all. They're just coming into the fullness of their own religion, into post-Messianic Judaism, if you will.
Now, after that testimony you just gave, and as a practicing Catholic, you still see yourself then as 100% Jewish. You haven't turned your back on Judaism whatsoever in your beliefs and in your heart of hearts and in your deepest recesses of your mind.
More than that, I'm much more Jewish than I could possibly have been without entering the Catholic Church.
In other words, I've heard it described, the entire Bible is promise, and that part of the Bible was given to us from the Jewish people. That's the Old Testament. The New Testament is fulfillment. And many Jews are waiting for the fulfillment. You have found it in Christ.
That's right. And the Catholic Church is post-Messianic Judaism.
That's a sentence to remember. The Catholic Church is post-Messianic Judaism. You know, and I'm jumping way ahead here, but I can't help but think that there's a reason you are given extraordinary graces. And I mentioned to our listeners that Roy's testimony is found in the back of his book, but also in the concluding section of your book, there's a number of striking testimonies. I mean, heaven seems very concerned, even at this stage of human history, to break through to Jewish people in the most remarkable ways. What I mean, you have to ask yourself, I know God broke through. I wasn't heading towards Catholicism. He broke through. You have to ask yourself, why did he do that? I'm sure you've asked yourself.
Well, I know where you're leading, but yes, it's very notable to me that virtually every Jewish conversion, in quotes, that I'm aware of, happened through miraculous intercession, usually involving the Blessed Virgin Mary. And part of the answer may be that the Jews, as the chosen people and as the first recipients of the covenant, there might be some special grace that God still gives them just out of respect for that covenant and who they are. But there is also that mysterious passage in Romans 11 that suggests that after the number of the Gentiles is completed, God will remove the veil from the eyes of the Jews, and they too will enter the church.
Now, I don't want to put you on the spot, but I'll put myself on the spot here. I've made some notes, if I can find it. Here we go. Right along with Romans chapter 11, when it says the times of the Gentiles are fulfilled, Jesus himself said, as recorded by St. Luke, he said, first, when you see Jerusalem surrounded by armies, know that its desolation is near. That's Luke 21:20. That's 70 A.D. Then let those who are in Judea depart to the mountains. And then he says in verse 24, and they'll fall by the edge of the sword and be led captive among all nations, and Jerusalem will be trodden down by the Gentiles until the times of the Gentiles are fulfilled. And quite frankly, I haven't heard too many of my Catholic brethren make mention of the fact that in June 1967, after the Six-Day War, for the first time in almost 2,000 years, Jerusalem is in the hands of the Jewish people. This is perhaps a huge signal to the world of something going on here.
I obviously agree. In my book, I stay away from prophecy qua prophecy and predicting anything in terms of dates
of
timelines.
As soon as you set a date, you're a false prophet.
But I do lay out the prophecies associated with the second coming and the end times from the scriptures and kind of juxtapose them with some of the things that are happening for the first time in our generation. One of them being, of course, that for the first time in 2,000 years, Jerusalem is not trod under the feet of the Gentiles.
Let's talk about the relationship of Jew-Gentile in God's plan. And you very clearly point out in your book, Romans 11. And again, I want to highlight to many of our listeners who may have read Catholic prophetic books, particularly there was quite a bit of interest prior to the year 2000, I noticed, along with some predictions, which should have given us a tip that something was amiss because we can't predict the date of the end. But nonetheless, that seemed to really ignore perhaps one of the most significant end times events. And it's not all the dramatic troubles in nature and nations or even the Antichrist, but there's something else, and we'll go through it. Let's just talk through Romans 11, and anybody can read this in their Bibles, but and the Catechism also talks about Romans 11. Give us the three stages, so to speak, that St. Paul lays out in Romans 11.
Well, it's evident that that God's initial covenant and special relationship was with the Jews through the Jewish covenant, which was a covenant through blood more than was through ritual observance, but also ritual observance. And that special relationship between God and man was universalized to the Gentiles with the coming of Christ and the Catholic Church, Catholic meaning universal. And for some mysterious reason, as Paul suggests in Romans 11, the eyes of the Jews were largely veiled to who Jesus was while the Gentiles were brought into the church.
So this was phase two, so to speak. The minority, a faithful remnant, did embrace Christ as the Messiah. The majority of the Jews experienced the veil, so to speak, over their eyes.
That's right.
And then it goes to the Gentile world, who basically had a veil over their eyes since the Garden of Eden and the original sin. And so you have the light going to the Gentiles as a second stage.
That's right. And St. Paul suggests very strongly that it wasn't only ill will or fallen human nature which kept the Jews from recognizing Jesus, but there was an active aspect of divine providence at work, where God actually actively hardened the hearts of the Jews so that they would not recognize Jesus until the number of the Gentiles was completed. And then he would reverse that process and enable the Jews to also come into the church.
So that stage three would be a ingathering, a fairly significant ingathering, just like it was such a surprise in Acts and caused all the frictions. What do we do with all these Gentiles who want to believe in the Messiah? There's coming a point of time in history when large numbers of Jews will be included. And God's plan in all this wasn't to exclude anyone, but to truly be the Savior of the world.
That's right. And for some mysterious reason, there had to be this interplay between Jew and Gentile, which, first of all, I may say, that in itself suggests that there's a meaningfulness to Jewish identity in between the first and second comings of Christ.
Okay.
Which is one of the reasons I wrote the book, is because Catholics, by and large, have thought about and acknowledged that there was a meaningfulness to Jewish identity before the first coming of Christ, because it was necessary to bring about the incarnation of God as man, as a Jewish man, and in the Jewish religion. But the Church has largely lost a sense that there's any meaningfulness to Jewish identity in between the first and second coming of Christ. But this passage in Romans kind of makes that a necessary conclusion to draw.
It does. I'd like to just read portions of section 674 from the Catechism, which says, "The glorious Messiah's coming is suspended at every moment of history until his recognition by all Israel." And so any prophetic scheme says the second coming of Christ is right around the corner, and there hasn't been a massive ingrafting, ingathering of the Jewish peoples to the Messiah. They've missed a key piece of the end times. It's right here. And it says further, "What will their acceptance mean but life from the dead? The full inclusion of the Jews in the Messiah's salvation in the wake of the full number of the Gentiles will enable the people of God to achieve the measure of the stature of the fullness of Christ, in which God will be all in all." And this is a major, if you want to say what's next on the prophetic clock, this has to take place before we move into any other scenario that people may be predicting and writing about. And what, quite frankly, grieves me is to see even Catholic prophetic books, and not some of the flaky, sensational ones that come from various quarters, but just to ignore this. And this is a part of the Catholic faith, and obviously it should prompt us to be praying,
right,
for the conversion of the Jews.
Exactly right, which is another thing which motivated this book, is my disappointment that I found in various places in the Catholic Church, not universally, around exactly this issue. They're turning their back on even hoping for the conversion of the Jews, much less actively praying for it or working for it. This false ecumenicism, this desire to have everyone like you and to pretend there's no reason for any conflict, and therefore, in the face of Jewish resistance to proselytization, backing off and saying, well, there's no reason for a Jew to become Catholic anyway. The Jews have their way to God. We have our way to God. I've even heard, excuse me for saying this, but from bishops, that God doesn't want the Jews to become Catholic. God only wants them to be good Jews. He intended Christianity for the Gentiles, not for the Jews, who always had their covenant, which remains in force.
Now, to speak up for those bishops, I would dare say, in their heart of hearts, they just simply want to be charitable to Jewish people who have had such a hard time in Western history. But as a Jew, would you say that's true or really a false charity being conveyed?
I think only a Jew can be allowed to take the fairly aggressive posture, perhaps, that I've taken towards the evangelization of the Jews, because you're exactly right. It's very noble-hearted and charitable for a Gentile Catholic to say, you know, especially after the Holocaust, after all the Jews have gone through, how can we rub salt in the wound and make them feel they're being attacked and we're trying to destroy their people and make them Catholics? Of course we have to respect their desire to preserve the Jewish people against that. I can understand that, and it is a feeling rooted in charity and goodwill, but I'm also aware, as a Jew, I apologize for hurting anyone's feelings, but the Jewish thirst for God cannot be satisfied outside of the Catholic Church. A Jew can't be fulfilled and happy in his Jewish nature without receiving the Blessed Sacrament, without knowing Jesus, without having a personal relationship with Jesus. It is a false charity which condemns Jews to a life of frustration if they are going to have a religious nature, that withholds from them the truth of the gospel.
And I don't know if these documents are really getting this connection, but in a certain sense they get so involved in trying to build ecumenical bridges, which may be based on an inaccurate perception, because the catechism itself is speaking of a mass conversion of Jews. And to say there's two parallel covenants and that Jewish people have no need to convert to the new covenant is almost an argument of self-contradiction with the defined Catholic faith.
Not almost, it is.
It is. And I'm being nice. Too nice.
With the words of Jesus. I mean, this is, of course, also a theme of the book. But Jesus didn't say, you know, I came first for the Samaritans and then to the Jews. He said, you know, I came first for the lost sheep of Israel.
And you mentioned in your book, and of course this is through the Old Testament, the younger son inheriting the promises is a sign of what? Explain that a little bit.
There is a theme that runs through the first few generations, or more than that, of the patriarchs in the Old Testament. There is a blessing which is passed down from the father to the eldest son, starting with Abraham and going on through, you know, through the patriarchs and then their successors. This special blessing, and time after time after time, although the father wanted to pass it on to the eldest son and was supposed to pass it on to the eldest son, the eldest son kind of failed him, and it was the younger son who received the blessing. Sometimes through subterfuge, like the case with Isaac and Esau, and sometimes through such blatant misbehavior that the father consciously withheld the blessing. Of course, a parable which brings across the same point is the parable of the prodigal son, where one can think of the eldest son who stands by rights to inherit as being the Jewish people, and the younger son, who starts out being very far from the father and far from God, therefore, coming back with his whole heart and kind of jumping in ahead of the eldest son, so to speak, in receiving the father's blessing. So I think that, I mean, the Jewish people play many roles in the Catholic faith. Now, the Catholic faith is just another word for how God works with humanity, because that's what the Catholic faith is. It's the full explication of how God works with humanity. But one of the roles that the Jewish people play is as being a kind of typological prefigurement of the relationship between God and man. And so I think that the story which recurs with the patriarchs over and over again is perhaps a prefigurement of what would happen later with the Gentiles jumping in ahead of the Jews in receiving the fullness of the Father's blessing.
And in that parable, the prodigal son, if you understand it with the scope of redemptive history, that elder son standing outside the home, the question is he going to enter the Father's house? And, of course, from St. Paul, we know that at some point in history, he will. And the Jewish people will enter the Father's house, and Jew and Gentile will be together in the Catholic faith.
I think St. Paul puts it perhaps even stronger. He says, essentially, if the Jews being cut off are a blessing to you Gentiles, what a blessing they'll be when they come back in.
Absolutely. We're going to go to a break, but stay with us. We're going to be back with more of Salvation is from the Jews.
Faith and Family is a radio ministry of the Family Life Center International, founded in 1993 by Steve Wood. In response to Pope John Paul II's call to re-evangelize the world through the family, the Family Life Center seeks to provide families around the world with resources to strengthen and encourage them. In 1995, Steve also founded an international Catholic men's ministry called St. Joseph's Covenant Keepers. If you'd like more information about our ministry, a free catalog, or a free sample St. Joseph's Covenant Keepers newsletter, please call our business office at 941-764-8565 or email your request from our website, www.dads.org. That's dads.org. We hope you'll visit us on the internet to learn more about this international Catholic apostolate that is changing lives and transforming families, the Family Life Center International, because the future of the world and the church passes through the family.
Welcome back to Faith and Family. I'm your host, Steve Wood. Today, I'm interviewing Roy Shoman, who is the author of the recently published book, Salvation is from the Jews. If you're just joining us, you're in store for a great half hour ahead. If you've been with us so far, I know you're going to want a copy of this book. So let me give you the order number if you'd like a copy of Roy Shoman's book, Salvation is from the Jews. It's 1-800-705-6131. And that number will work any business day between 9 and 5. It's 1-800-705-6131. Salvation is from the Jews. And I also want to give you Roy's website. It's salvationisfromthejews.com. It's the same as the title of his book. Roy, there is a couple of things in your book that were real surprises to me, as well as very informative. I think you had some insights, particularly I'm thinking of the starting about page 135 in your book, when you start talking about Judaism and the Holocaust, and you kind of set this up in the first half hour where you mentioned that obviously the Jews had a big role to play in preparing for Christianity. I mean, Christianity is built on Judaism. It's all fitting together. But you alluded to what is the role of the Jews between the two comings of Christ? Because many Christians would think, well, maybe there's not much there, or thinking there's not much of importance happening in the world. Obviously, the Holocaust was one of the most horrific things that have ever happened in human history. But put this into perspective of salvation history for us.
Well, you actually introduced the first step of that. It's perhaps easier to look backwards from the second coming. If, in fact, the scriptures make clear that before the second coming there will be a mass conversion of the Jews or entry of the Jews into the church, that implies two things. One is that there will be Jews, and the other is that they will enter the church. One can see the Holocaust as an attempt to eradicate the Jews as its primary goal, and as a secondary goal, if it fails to eradicate the Jews, to prevent their entry into the church. Now, it succeeded to some extent in both of those agendas. It wiped out two-thirds of the Jews in Europe. And it certainly put a tremendous stumbling block against Jewish conversion or Jewish entry into the church, both because of all of the ill will that it generated on the part of Jews who were mistakenly taught that the Holocaust was somehow an expression of Christianity, and also in the way it's gotten the Christian community to back off from the conversion of the Jews out of respect for the tragedy of the Holocaust. So, you know, putting two and two together, one can say, well, gee, who is it whose number one goal in life is to block the second coming? And, gee, if the Holocaust was so perfectly designed to achieve that end, then maybe it was that entity behind the Holocaust.
Putting two and two together, again, a couple of scriptures that we've already alluded to. Romans 11, that before the second coming, there's the full inclusion of the Jews. Luke 21, saying until the Gentiles will be trotting down Jerusalem until the times of the Gentiles are fulfilled. It was immediately after World War II that perhaps the fulfillment of Luke 21 kicked into gear, foreseeing what could happen, and we're talking about a diabolical enemy who can foresee things such as that, has a strategy as horrific as the Holocaust.
That's right. And the diabolical roots of the Holocaust are all too evident if one dispassionately examines the history. There was a tremendous amount of overt Satanism associated with the Holocaust. The chief exorcist of Rome, Father Gabriel Amorth, said that it is a certainty that Hitler was personally consecrated to Satan. There's a lot of evidence of satanic activities on his part, and occult activities were the entire undergirding of the Nazi Party from before it actually emerged. It emerged out of an occult brotherhood. That has gone into detail with completely historical, verified facts and documents in my book.
You also mentioned there was rampant sexual immorality, including widespread homosexuality amongst the chief leadership of the Nazis, including the SS, pervading the SS.
That's right. The stormtroopers, who were the first military arm of the Nazis, were headed by a notorious overt homosexual who made no pretense about his homosexuality and was continually the cause of scandal, so much so that Hitler actually occasionally had to make public statements saying it's no one's business, you know, what he does in the bathhouses and how he runs around with boys. And one could barely be in the Stormtroopers and certainly couldn't stand any chance of advancement without being an active homosexual.
And the Nazi youth movements was simply another area where the homosexuality was spreading?
So much so that in mainstream German newspapers carried warnings to parents against allowing your sons to be initiated into homosexuality through the Hitler Youth. Now, I know this is a controversial issue. Again, all of the documentation in my book is primary sources. It's newspapers of the time. It's reports of the time. It's not secondhand stuff. It's not hearsay. This was very well known. My father, who is a Holocaust refugee, he was aware of it, and he says that everyone was aware of it at the time. I mean, if you were in Germany at the time, you knew about the deep intertwining of Nazi activities and active homosexuality.
Now, the reason I'm bringing this up, I'm going to connect a few dots here, or try to, for people in this broadcast, the things that are happening in our world, because this isn't something that just was a momentary mob hysteria. At least that's the thesis that you and I share, that there's something very diabolical behind this. Did I remember correct that even Hitler himself had an arrest for some type of immoral act?
There are OSS documents, that's the predecessor to the CIA, that refer to Hitler having been arrested as a homosexual prostitute in Vienna in his youth. That's correct. The originals of those documents disappeared. It's not too surprising, if the documents really existed, that Hitler would have arranged for them to have disappeared, but not before Mussolini apparently had them in his possession and made explicit reference to having possession of those documents also. So this is an area that gets controversy, but I think the weight of the evidence is overwhelmingly in favor that this is a true story.
Now, I'm sure our listeners have gotten this, but my job as host is to take the highlighter to some of our words on the air here. I mean, in our day, we're facing a rampant sexual immorality and aggressive homosexuality spreading through the world. Coinciding with this, we're seeing a rampant anti-Semitism, and I'm not just talking about the charges against Mel Gibson. I'm talking about real people bombing and seeking the literal destruction of the Jews, not only from Palestine, but as well as wishing them ill will from the earth, their eradication from the earth. So, I mean, this move has not left our world, and to underscore this, the most surprising thing in your book is a certain connection between certain Muslim Arab leaders and Nazism. I found this absolutely shocking, and I'm going to ask you to elaborate on that.
Well, first of all, the Islamic scriptures do say that the resurrection of the resurrection, the end of the world, and the entry into the heavenly kingdom for everyone cannot take place until all the Jews are exterminated. And that's in the sayings of Muhammad. Again, that's documented in the book. Obviously, the place where you see today the most concerted effort actually to exterminate the Jews is in the Arab world. I know some people will say, oh, no, it's not against the Jews. It's just against the state of Israel. But read what they say. I mean, read the statements by the Muslim leaders. Read the statements even by the government leaders. They're not uniquely opposed to Zionism and the state of Israel. They talk about having to get rid of all the Jews in the world.
That's correct.
Now, at the time of World War II, there was a tremendous amount of sympathy for Hitler in the Arab world. There were Arab leaders who actively aligned themselves with Hitler. There was the Grand Mufti of Jerusalem, al-Husseini, actually spent two or three of the war years in Berlin as a valued guest of the German government.
You have a picture here of him reviewing Nazi troops.
I have a picture there also of him in an intimate tête-à-tête with Hitler. He set up they were called the Hanjar, a division of Nazi SS troops made up out of Bosnian Muslims who perpetrated some of the worst atrocities of the war, including, by the way, destroying all of the churches, you know, in huge areas, and, of course, exterminating the Jews. And that was part of his job that was given to him by Hitler. He agreed to, actually, on the condition that he would be given permission after the war to set up concentration camps and exterminate all the Jews in the Middle East. And in return, he set up these Muslim troops to aid the SS.
Now, what really caught my attention, this Muslim leader who was wanted for war crimes and everything else after the war, he had a nephew. And we hear his nephew's name in the paper all the time.
Yes.
Listen, folks, this is a man who formed the alliance with Hitler to exterminate the Jews. This hasn't ended. It continues in the modern world. Listen very carefully to what you're about to hear from Roy.
Okay. First of all, the nephew with the well-known name to whom you're referring is Yasser Arafat. If people are in the know about this, there are people out there who will contest that fact. And the reason they will contest that fact, and it's difficult to silence that contestation entirely, is that Yasser Arafat has actually been reliably quoted at various times as proudly asserting being the nephew of al-Husseini and vehemently denying it, depending on who his audience was and what served his purposes at the time. So one has to go back to those particular interviews, those particular people he was talking to and the circumstances, and determine, yes, the times when it didn't matter what he said, he proudly asserted it, and the times when he denied it, he had a very specific reason for denying it. But yes, he grew up in his household in Egypt under al-Husseini as his mentor. There are lots of quotes that appeared in his own press at the time of al-Husseini's death, referring to him as their revered leader. It's an honor to follow in his footsteps and so forth. And again, the primary documentation is cited in the book.
And again, we're highlighting that there's a strategy behind this. This isn't some kind of just mob-induced hysteria, but we're talking about a diabolical strategy to frustrate the plan of God, which includes the Jews. You mentioned another protege of Husseini, I guess. Is that how you pronounce his name?
I pronounce it Husseini. Yes.
Husseini. He had a grandson who had a nephew who visited him, and his nephew saw the large portrait of Adolf Hitler in his room, and that nephew has had an awful lot of press lately in the world as well. Did I get that right?
Not 100%.
All right. We'll get it close.
Saddam Hussein grew up in the house of his uncle, which was a house that consisted of essentially one meeting room and you know, small rooms for sleeping in, and that one room was dominated by a large portrait of Adolf Hitler, who was the uncle's hero.
Of
Saddam Hussein.
Of Saddam Hussein. Okay. And also you mentioned that Anwar Sadat, which even here on Catholic radio, I've heard that he was a moderate following the 9/11 tragedy. In page 265, you say he's often called a moderate, but would Anwar Sadat, would it be accurate to say that he was a moderate? And I'm talking about in relation to the Jews?
Well, shortly after the war, he wrote a letter to Hitler. He didn't know that Hitler had died, which says in part, "I congratulate you from the bottom of my heart. You succeeded in creating dissensions between Churchill, the old man, and his allies, the sons of Satan. Even if you appear to have been defeated, in reality you are the victor. There will be no peace unless Germany once again becomes what she was," referring to the Third Reich. It makes my blood run cold to think that that might qualify him as a moderate. In fact, it might in some perverse sense qualify him as a moderate,
yeah,
but it's not what we would think of as moderate at all.
Well, I would just encourage our listeners who have any concern with what's going on in our world, what we have been through, and what we are facing in the future to get a hold of Roy's book. That's 1-800-705-6131. I'll just state one further because, you know, again, he was called a moderate. He wrote in 1953 while a government minister, and I'm citing here from Roy's book on page 266, Hitler was wronged and slandered, for he did no more to the Jews than the European people who slaughtered the Jews before him. He was trying to save the world from this malignant evil. This is not good stuff. We find in 1999, this is further from Roy's book, Mein Kampf by Hitler was the sixth bestseller amongst Palestinian Arabs. Now, I've gotten many criticisms right from this broadcast for trying to alert Catholics for the situation of the modern world that the Muslim faith poses. And I get criticisms like, you know, don't worry, Steve, be happy. And, you know, there's a concern here.
I strongly recommend any of those critics should just pick up a copy of the Quran and read the Quran, especially Book 9, but read the whole Quran, be fair-minded. Read the authoritative Muslim biography of Muhammad, and then say what Islam is really all about.
And you mentioned in your book there's a uniqueness to Islam that very often those who are thinking and studying world religions don't really take into account.
Well, my understanding or my view of this is that obviously Christianity, and in particular the Catholic faith, is the revealed the truth revealed directly by God or indirectly by God as to the relationship between God and man and salvation. All non-Christian religions, all significant non-Christian religions, came about before Christ, with the exception of Islam. So they were either not revelations at all or partial revelations or polluted revelations, but they were innocent in a sense because the truth had not yet been revealed, and so perhaps their prophets or their proponents were doing the best they could with the little they had. Islam is unique among world religions in having come about after Christianity and having come about purportedly as the result of a divine revelation after Christianity. If Islam is in fact based on a revelation, one has to ask, what is the source of that revelation? Could it be God? Would God reveal something after he revealed the fullness of the truth in Christianity that contradicted it? That seems very unlikely. The only choices available are that Islam is in fact a revelation, in which case it is a revelation coming from a spiritual being or hierarchy opposed to God and his truth, or it's not based on revelation at all.
Now, I hate to do this to you. We only have a minute left, but having a Jewish convert to Catholicism in my studio, you've seen Mel Gibson's The Passion of Christ?
Yes.
And you've met with Mel Gibson?
That's correct.
All right. Give us, in 60 seconds, your view of The Passion of Christ, particularly from a Jewish perspective.
First of all, I mean, I love the movie. I will say that there was something that I felt very similar about The Passion of Christ in my book, what Mel was setting out to do and what I was setting out to do, and I think that's reflected in the fact that he wanted to meet me and in our conversation, which is painting a picture in terms of the battle, in terms of spiritual warfare, in terms of the battle between God and the good guys and the leader of the bad guys. And that structure is revealed both in my book and in the movie. I think that the movie, this isn't what you expected to hear, but there's a sense in which it is anti-Semitic, okay? Because Christianity and Judaism can't both be right. Now, if you're going to call that anti-Semitic, then the movie's anti-Semitic. Because the movie, simply by being a faithful portrayal of the Gospels and a faithful portrayal of Christianity, makes the viewer confront the fact that Jesus was the Jewish Messiah who came to the Jews, and what now calls itself Judaism denies that fact, contradicts that fact. So either Christianity is right or Judaism is right. There's nothing, no other aspect of it which can fairly be called anti-Semitism.
All right, we're out of time, but one quick question. Do you think Jews will be led to the Messiah through the Passion?
Let us all hope and pray that that is the case.
All right. I am interviewing Roy Shoman. Salvation is from the Jews. If you want a copy, 1-800-705-6131. Until next time, this is Steve Wood with Faith and Family.